So, as Vincent has said, we're going to be starting a new series of talks at the Mission, and we're going to be looking at 1 and 2 Kings. Over the coming weeks, we'll be wandering through the whole two books, looking at Israel's monarchy, and we'll be introduced to a number of specific kings who were charged with the responsibility of leading Israel, and we'll be finding out how they got on with their jobs. I don't know what your view of studying history is. Maybe it fills you with a sense of excitement and anticipation as we begin to learn about conspiracies and dramas that took place. Or maybe you just slump back in your chair and the prospect of studying history means at least you're going to be able to catch up on some sleep in the next 20 minutes or so. Well, for my own part, history was one of the few subjects that I enjoyed at school, but I didn't really have much of a head for remembering the facts. The two main historical periods that I studied for my GCSE history was India's struggle for independence and World War II, classic moments in recent history. I think my main downfall in my exam was the version of events I retold surrounding India's fight for liberation in the 1940s, which had India's pivotal hero, Gandhi, spearheading a full frontal, bloody confrontation against the British, making full use of its huge army of German SS stormtroopers. I don't think I had fully appreciated the implications of Gandhi's strategy of passive resistance at the time. However, you will be pleased to hear that my historical research has been a little bit more thorough this time, and that there's not a jackboot in sight as we reconsider Israel's history. I don't know how well you know 1 and 2 Kings, or indeed how much of a handle you have of the Old Testament. For many of us, the Old Testament is a confusing set of books, which sometimes leave us with the impression that the God of the Old Testament is a bloodthirsty, angry, and vengeful God who on numerous occasions brutalizes his own people, all seemingly in contrast to the loving and gracious God portrayed in the New Testament. It's worth stating right at the start of this series, as we think about the kings of Israel, that as committed, believing Christians, When we come to study this Old Testament, biblical history, this history is our spiritual history. The promises and calling of God given to Israel throughout the whole of the Old Testament are also our historical promises and calling. The collection of books that comes before Matthew form the foundations of our faith. And the Old and the New Testament should not be treated separately from each other. As Galatians 3 puts it, if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. We cannot hold the God of the Old Testament at arm's length and deny any kind of association, no matter how unpalatable the stories are. We must seek to try and learn what the character and the nature of our living God is like based on these historical records. As Romans tells us, everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through endurance and the encouragement of scriptures, we might have hope. So then, to Kings. And it's my job this morning to give an overview of the books and provide a taste of the major themes that it depicts and records in 47 chapters that form 1 and 2 Kings. So brace yourselves. Here we go. For many Bible commentators, the two books, 1 and 2 Kings, should be treated as one and simply called Kings. And it should be seen as a sequel to 1 and 2 Samuel. The four books together present the circumstances that led to the birth of Israel's monarchy, their royal family, and the consequences it had on the nation over the following 500 years or so. Kings itself covers about 400 years of history. At the start of the book, at 1 Kings, Israel, to a certain extent, is at peace with its neighbours and is enjoying the blessings and security of God under the godly rule of King David, who at this point is coming to the end of his 40-year reign. By the end of 2 Kings, the kingdom has split into two. There have been numerous wars and power struggles with the surrounding neighbours, which ultimately end in the unthinkable. The people of Israel lose the promised land. They are captured and forced out of their homes and into exile by Assyria and Babylon, who were the two major superpowers of the day. The land is ransacked by the Babylonians, and all the important buildings are burnt to the ground, including perhaps the most significant building, the temple in Jerusalem, the place where God is thought to live. The holy city and the home of God are gone by the end of 2 Kings. And you could be forgiven for thinking, like probably many of the exiled Jews at the time, what went wrong? How could the Lord allow this to happen to his chosen people? And this is the key question that the writer of 1 and 2 Kings wants to try and address, and one that we will see answers to later. The spiralling downward journey of Israel's history and kings can be structured into three main sections. First section is 1 Kings 1 to 1 Kings 11. Solomon's anointed king by his father David, and Solomon enjoys an unprecedented golden reign of peace and prosperity for 40 years, during which he builds God's permanent dwelling place, the temple in Jerusalem, which takes him 7 years to complete. You'll remember that up until this point, God has been living in a big tent, the tabernacle. Then 1 Kings 12 to 2 Kings 17, which is the biggest section, is the second part of the structure. This is where Israel is torn into two by a rebellion. After Solomon's death and during the reign of his son, Rehoboam, 10 tribes form a northern kingdom, which is known throughout the book as Israel. And 1 tribe forms a southern kingdom, which is called Judah throughout the book. This split, this rebellion, is foretold by the Lord to Solomon and to a chap called Jeroboam. You're going to hear some amazing names over the next few weeks. Jeroboam is the first king of the northern kingdom, Israel, in chapter 11. And the split takes place in chapter 12 of 1 Kings, thought to be in the year around 930 BC. And the rest of that section, up to 2 Kings 17, basically records all the kings that lived and ruled over the two split kingdoms. And in the final section, 2 Kings 18 to 2 Kings 25, by this point, the people of the northern kingdom Israel have been overwhelmed by the Assyrians. Everyone has been removed from the kingdom. Only the southern kingdom Judah remains. And this last section basically follows the demise of that remaining tribe and the southern kingdom, which includes the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, all done at the hands of the Babylonians. So at the point, turn that off now. Cheers, Vince. At the point of the split in Israel, in 1 Kings 12, to the end of 2 Kings, we have 40 kings ruling over two kingdoms. These split evenly into 20 kings ruling over the northern kingdom, Israel, and 20 kings in the southern kingdom, Judah, over a period of about 350 years. Some of these kings, no doubt you've heard of, like Ahab and Hezekiah. Time for a bit of Bible trivia now. Anyone heard of any of the other names of the two kingdoms in Israel? You care to shout out? Well, maybe another question. Anyone know who had the longest reign out of the 40 kings? Sorry? Josiah? It wasn't Josiah, no. It was a chap called Manasseh. who was the son of Hezekiah. He reigned in Judah for 55 years. And one of the highlights of his reign was that he sacrificed his son to an idol in a fire. Nice one, Dad. The shortest reign in the 40 kings, any ideas? This was a chap called Zimri. Oh yeah, Zimri. He ruled in Israel, the northern kingdom, for 7 days. And he died at the end of a siege. He basically set fire to his palace and he died in the flames of his own palace. The youngest king of his installation, any ideas? Who was the youngest when he came to the throne? Joash, actually. We'll come on to Josiah. Joash, in 2 Kings 11, we're told, he was 7 when he became king over Judah, a 7-year-old in charge of a nation. Man had done a brilliant job. Actually, he did do a brilliant job. He was the grandson of someone called Athaliah. She was actually the only woman in the whole of the history to rule over a kingdom. There was one woman, we actually have a queen. And she ruled over the southern kingdom, Judah, for 6 years. She got to the throne by wiping out her entire son's family and took the throne. The other significant and crucial characters mentioned in Kings are the prophets, who the Lord uses to announce all the judgments, the impending disasters, all the blessings to each king and their respective kingdom. And the most famous of these in Kings are Elijah and Elisha. What becomes really interesting as you read through Kings is the consistent way the writer presents each king from 1 Kings 12 onwards. Turn with me to 2 Kings 15. It's on page 386. We're going to be darting around a bit, so you'll have to bear with me a little bit. 2 Kings 15 and verse 23. So the basic structure of the introduction of each king, the king was, it was marked by how long the king reigned for, which year it took place in the reign of the opposite kingdom's king, who his father was. Sometimes we're told additional information like how old he was and when he came to the throne and who his mother was. But most significantly, each time we're told if the king was faithful or evil. And we see examples of this in 2 Kings 15, verse 23-24. In the 50th year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekahiah, son of became king of Israel and Samaria, and he reigned for 2 years. Pekahiah did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he caused Israel to commit. Verse 27. In the 52nd year of Azariah, king of Judah, Pekah, son of Remaliah, became king of Israel and Samaria, and he reigned for 20 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he had caused Israel to commit. And then verse 32. In the 2nd year of Pekah, son of Remaliah, king of Israel, Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem for 16 years. His mother's name was Jerusha, daughter of Zadok. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father Uzziah had done. So that's a bit of a flavour of the structure of each king. What is hugely significant within the narrative of the two books is that out of the 40 kings mentioned from 1 Kings 12 onwards, who ruled over the two kingdoms, only 7 are described as faithful, of which Jotham, in verse 32, is one of them. One of the faithful 7 is described as a unique king. That was Hezekiah. All of the 7 ruled over Judah, the kingdom with Jerusalem as its capital and the home to God's temple. All of the northern kings were considered evil. And the most evil king out of the 33, as we read in 1 Kings 21, is Ahab, who Elijah spends most of his life opposing and condemning. Based on this consistent structure, it becomes apparent that the single most important criteria that the writer of Kings uses to measure every king by is whether or not he or she faithfully follow the covenant, the agreement made between God and his people, the law given through the prophet Moses. Great expectations and responsibility had been set for Israel's monarchy. And what the writer does in Kings is effectively hold the 40 kings accountable to these responsibilities. And we see them spelt out by the priest Samuel when he anoints the very first king of Israel, the king of God's people, Saul. If you can turn to 1 Samuel 12, which is on page 281, Catherine is going to come and read that for us. So here we have the expectations for king and country spelt out effectively in a rebuke from Samuel. Having qualified his own godly credentials in verses 1 to 5, in verses 6 to 12, Samuel reminds Israel that they already have a king, namely God, who has continually intervened to save his people from impending threats from surrounding nations, as declared in verses 8 and 10. The Lord has been in control, and it was he who brought Israel to the promised land and defeated her enemies. Now we see the request for a king comes from the people, and at a point when Israel face a new threat from the Ammonites in verse 12. Israel have forgotten that they already have a ruler and a deliverer, and the request is seen as a direct rejection of the Lord and his authority. But the request is granted, and a question is asked, and an expectation is set. Will an earthly king make any difference to Israel's situation and status? It's actually the same kind of expectation that is set at the end of Judges. That's the book that 1 Samuel follows on from. You remember that in the last verse of Judges, it says, "In those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit." Will an earthly king make Israel a stronger, better, more stable, and more significant nation? The answer is yes, providing there is utter submission and obedience to the Lord's commands, as Samuel instructs in verses 14 to 15 and verses 20 to 25 in 1 Samuel 12. But the reality is that Israel could have just as easily been a stronger and better and more stable nation with or without a king. These same conditions of blessing applied before any request of a king was granted. The arrangement hadn't actually changed between God and his people. Do not turn away from the Lord after useless idols, but serve him faithfully, following his commands. This is the most important requirement expected of the kings, and the standard that the author of Kings uses to measure the 40 kings that come from 1 Kings 12 onwards. Honour the Lord and honour his agreements with you is the command that Samuel levels at king and country. I guess most of you are aware of the progress of the Hutton Inquiry that's currently taking place surrounding the events of communications that led our country to war against Iraq. The leaders of the UK are being held accountable over the decisions made up in the run-up to the war and to the events surrounding the death of the weapons expert, Dr. David Kelly. Nothing else matters within the government's political achievements or reputation. Within the inquiry, it doesn't matter how good, or for that matter, how bad, their policies are on the NHS or on education. It makes no odds how successful they have been in controlling our economy. It makes no difference that the government's policies appear to have brought down the number of asylum seekers. Nor does it matter how good our government's international reputation is. None of these things will have any bearing on the outcome of the inquiry. All that matters is whether there has been deceit and manipulation of the facts in the heart of the Iraqi dossier and the public ousting of Dr. Kelly, which seemingly led to his death. By the same token, the writer of Kings is not interested in the social, economic, or political achievements of any of the kings within his kingdom, whether in Israel or in Judah. All that is important is whether the king was faithful. Did the king turn away from the Lord, or did he obey his commands? A case in point is King Omri, the father of Ahab, and the king of the northern kingdom, Israel, who is mentioned in 1 Kings 16. Historically, sources outside of biblical history, the Bible, have King Omri as a hugely significant king on an international status, who, amongst other things, established an incredibly powerful dynasty in the region of Israel, the northern kingdom, and built a capital city for the northern kingdom, a city that rivaled the beauty and the splendor of Solomon's Jerusalem, calling it Samaria. Yet Omri's entire reign and stature is summed up in six verses in 1 Kings 16, where he's described as an evil king who sinned more than any other king up until his reign. None of Omri's achievements mattered before the measuring stick used by God. Omri was morally and spiritually bankrupt, having turned his back on the Lord and led the people of Israel into sin. As some of you are aware, much to the shock of my parents and catching them almost by surprise, I recently turned 30. It kind of shocked me too. It almost seems a bit like I no longer have any excuses. It's time to behave myself and act a little bit more adult. I'm definitely a big boy now. Obviously, I don't feel any physical difference in turning 30, but mentally it has felt quite strange to wave goodbye to my 20s. To talk of legacies is somewhat premature, God willing. But turning 30 has encouraged me to reflect on what I've been able to achieve as I face my fourth decade on earth. I'm amazed I'm still around. I think the big challenge that faces me, and actually faces all of us, is not what do I want to achieve in my short earthly life, but will I be faithful in humbling myself under God's mighty hand? Or will I turn my back on him? What stops me making the same mistakes as the kings? In reading Kings, it becomes abundantly clear that on one level, there is nothing within my own strength or abilities that will keep me faithfully submitting to the Lord. The most consistent and persistent problem that virtually every king commits is the pursuit and worship of idols. Human-fashioned and focused objects that provide the kings with status and significance, but flew in the face of the commands set before them by the Lord through Samuel in the passage we read in 1 Samuel 12. The sin of idolatry is there from the start of Kings to the end. We read in chapter 11 that it's Solomon's idolatry that leads to a split kingdom. Then when seemingly a new start is enabled, when the Lord calls and installs Jeroboam, the first king of the northern kingdom, he too falls into idolatry. In his fear over losing the allegiance of the Jews, living in the northern kingdom at the time, Jeroboam makes two golden calves, which become the focus of the region's worship. This blatant rejection of the Lord becomes a massive stain in Israel, and Jeroboam's idolatry becomes a recurring image as a comparison for future kings' infidelity. The repeated refrain He walked or followed the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, which he caused Israel to commit, appears on numerous occasions in Kings. So in seeking to tackle the question, what went wrong? How could the Lord allow this destruction to happen to his chosen people? The writer of Kings explains that the downfall of the nation is actually the work of their own hands, quite literally in fashioning idols. They are culpable and beyond excuse in bringing down their king and their country. 2 Kings 17 serves as a great summary to Israel's pathetic and humiliating end, at a point where the northern kingdom has been ransacked and the people have been carried off to Assyria. Turn to page 388, and Catherine's going to come and read verses 7 to 18 for us. We all have individual ambitions and desires for our lives. We have vocational ambitions. We want to make the most of our career opportunities. At times, nothing gives me more satisfaction than the thought that one day I might be nominated for the infamous Turner Prize. We have personal desires too. We desire to have satisfied and fulfilled lives. We want to meet a stable and faithful life companion. We want to be the best parents we can be. We want our kids to get the best education possible. We want security, safety, and health for our families. Nothing is wrong in these ambitions in themselves. The problem comes when they become the central focus in our lives, and we end up pushing our trust in the Lord to the margins. In effect, allowing human fashioned and focused desires, which provide status, significance, and security, to prevent us from trusting in the Lord. In other words, when they become idols. We may not offer our sons and daughters in the fire, nor bow down to the starry hosts, or Asherah poles, or Baal, but the reality of idols is no less a threat to our own walk with the Lord. In many respects, our idols are a lot more subtle than explained here in 2 Kings 17, but no less destructive. And yet, in spite of the mess and the turmoil that much of Kings retells, regardless of the chaos and the destructions that the kingdom spiral into, there are constant reminders in Kings of God's desire to see his people change. Moments when his merciful intervention can be seen again and again, as we'll see in the coming weeks as we look at individual kings. One example is in the life of Ahab, king of Israel, who, as we were thinking earlier and seeing earlier, is described as the most evil king, and who, you remember, did more to provoke the Lord's anger than all the other kings before him. In 1 Kings 21, Elijah confronts Ahab with the Lord's judgment, the judgment that's come at the hand of all that Ahab has done in his evil reign and his contempt for the Lord. And Ahab's response to Elijah's warning is pretty surprising, as is what follows. In verse 25, in 1 Kings 21, it reads, "There was never a man like Ahab, who sold himself to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, urged on by Jezebel his wife. He behaved in the vilest manner by going after idols, like the Amorites the Lord drove out before Israel." When Ahab heard these words, the words of Elijah's judgment and the Lord's judgment, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and fasted. He lay in sackcloth and went around meekly. The word of the Lord came to Elijah the Tishbite. "Have you noticed how Ahab has humbled himself before me? Because he has humbled himself, I will not bring this disaster in his day, but I will bring it on his house in the days of his son." It seems to me that if the Lord is prepared to accept the repentance and humble confession of the most evil and despicable king in Israel, There is hope for a wretch like me. Let's pray. I want to use a prayer that was regularly said by the great 17th century Christian politician William Wilberforce. O Lord, purify our souls from all their stains. Warm our hearts with the love of Thee. Animate our sluggish natures. And fix our inconstancy and volatility, that we may not be weary in well-doing. Amen. Next week,